Hey everyone, I'm Ryan Kalamea.
And I'm Amy Gosha.
Welcome to The Divorce at Altitude, a podcast on Colorado family law.
Divorce is not easy. It really sucks. Trust me, I know. Besides being an experienced divorce attorney, I'm also a divorce client.
Whether you are someone considering divorce or a fellow family law attorney, listen in for weekly tips and insight into topics related to divorce, co-parenting, and separation in Colorado. Welcome back to another episode of Divorce at Altitude. This is Ryan Kalamea. This week, we are joined by Mike DeManna, who is a mediator and attorney down in Denver. Mike, how you doing?
Good morning, Ryan. I'm doing just great.
So I'm going to skip over, we talked about before recording, I'm going to skip over the kind of celebratory introduction. And instead, I wanted to ask you, how did you get into law? Like, how did you decide you wanted to become a lawyer? And let's start from there.
Well, I was the firstborn male to my family, an Italian North Denver Catholic family. So my career path was pretty much set. I was supposed to go to the seminary and then become a priest. That's what happens to all firstborn Italian boys. However, before I got there, I talked my mother into letting me go to the University of Colorado in Boulder for just one semester. I said, Mom, you let me do that for just one semester, I'll go down this other route. Well, after being at CU Boulder for one semester, the priesthood was completely out of the question now. And so since I had been doing debate, public speaking, and so on throughout high school, winning some state competitions and so on, I decided that I'd give my shot at trying to become a lawyer. So that's how I got to law school.
You know, it's interesting. You and I had never talked about that before, but my father, he was the first graduating class from Matchbuff and grew up in Denver and then went to Notre Dame, which for Catholic, boys, that was it. But he spent some time at the seminary and then he had a different realization. He had a realization that he liked girls. And so he left the seminary because of that. Fortunately, he married my mom. But, it's always interesting to hear people's stories. How did you get into family law?
Well, because I was born in Denver, I had a lot of connections. So when I graduated from law school, I opened up my own shop. And so I took everything from wills and estates to traffic, criminal, family law, and so on. And what became apparent to me after about the first year of doing a general practice is that it was really necessary to do a specialty. So at that point, I did both criminal defense as well as family law. I got out of my criminal defense practice in the year 2000 and just concentrated solely on family law at that point. But here in the next few months, I'll have been practicing law for 50 years and all of that in family law and certainly a portion of it in criminal defense work.
Well, I don't know if I will last 50 years, but that is impressive, Mike, to do it at that level. And as we know, both of us, I mean, it's emotional and it can be, exhausting because you're going through these emotional aspects. Well, how did you get into being a mediation? And one of the main points of our conversation today is to talk about mediation, arbitration, and then MEDARB. So when did you start doing mediation?
My partner and I owned a law building. I think maybe you've actually been there. It was on 17th and High Street. I worked in there for over 40 years, just left last August to come downtown and be part of a larger office. In any event, one of my tenants was a lady by the name of Joan McWilliams. And Joan had started a mediation practice about 2 or 3 years before she moved into my building. And so she came up to my office one day and she said, look, how would you like to join me as being a mediator and do some of that kind of work in addition to your litigation? And I thought, well, what the heck, I'd give it a try. So about 20 some years ago, I started out with Joan to do mediation, and then my mediation, arbitration, alternative dispute resolution practice has just kind of grown from there and is what it is now.
We've engaged, mediation and done actually an arbitration, but it's always curious to see how litigators kind of transition over. We've had Joan on the podcast. How long do you think it took you to become good at mediation? Because it's a different skill set. And I'd be curious for you to comment on the kind of different skills and differences between litigation and mediation. But first off, how long do you think it took before you became actually somewhat good at it?
Well, It didn't take long at all, mostly because people would be coming to me because they were aware of my litigation background. So they knew I was a litigator. And as such, and now over a course of almost five decades as a litigator, there's not much I haven't tried myself. Sometimes I've won it, sometimes I've lost it. So as a mediator, I'm able to bring that kind of experience into the mediation realm and say to people, hey, look, you know, I understand where you're coming from on this. I appreciate your position on it. Let me just tell you, I had a case similar to that a few years ago or a few months ago, whatever. Here's what happened. So bringing some of the benefit of that experience. Once that word got out, so to speak, that I was more of a settlement master than an actual mediator, we can talk about the differences if you want, then my mediation practice began to grow and more people were coming to me as a result of that. And so that's kind of where that went.
Yeah, in your mind, what's the difference between a settlement master and a mediator?
Well, a mediator should not express an opinion about the various aspects of a case. A settlement master will do that and will say, look, I understand what your position is. Let me just tell you what my opinion is, just my opinion. I mediate for people with lawyers, so they have legal advice there, not relying upon me for legal advice. And so I can actually go into saying, well, look, I just don't think that's going to work for you, or that position's pretty weak. You better rethink it. Or yeah, you do have a strong position and I can convey that to the other side now. Whereas I think true mediator really is supposed to refrain from kind of doing that. I tend to know in my own cases that I take to mediation, I want to hear this neutral's opinion about the position that my client and I are taking. Because mediation, of course, there's nothing binding in it. So if I've got a bad situation and it's sounding bad to now this third party neutral mediator, and they tell me that, I'd rather hear it in that context and have my client hear it in that context than a judge making a decision on the issue, because there's not much we can do about it at that point.
Yeah. And I'd never heard the term special or settlement master. I mean, obviously there's the technical term of special master, but like you, I mean, I am a 100% litigator and I really appreciate the mediators and I will seek out you being one of them in terms of if you're unable to settle the case, it's always, you know, you can explain to your client that the value is that we get a neutral opinion about the strengths and the weaknesses. And so if we are, I mean, obviously you go into a mediation trying to get the case settled, but if you don't, then at least you can walk away with some assessment of the strengths and weaknesses. And when the mediator just shuttles back and forth and just passes along offers, it's like, two attorneys, we could do that. And it's more of having another set of eyes on it, another set of ears and another perspective. And sometimes I might need help with my client in terms of their expectations and that the client hearing it from somebody, the same thing that I've been telling them or disagrees with me. And that might be what breaks the case.
Yeah. And I personally, in my own cases that I take to mediation, because as you know, we have to mediate everything now before we can go to court, I do find that to be very helpful. And I know that as a mediator, I've had lawyers come in and say to me, hey, look, I'm having a difficult position with my client on this issue. I don't know what you think about it, but if you could be of some help to that, that would help me get my client over the hurdle. And so I don't mind doing that. And we'll say to people, listen, I understand where you are. I've been doing this for a while. I've got the emotional part of it, and I understand how important this is to you, but you just have no chance. This is just not going to happen. Or if it does, it would be an outlier. And I can almost assure you the other side will be wanting to take it for a look at by a higher court. And now your case is just going to continue on. So maybe a little bit different approach, moving a little bit towards the center might help the case get settled.
And you mentioned that other divorce lawyers and that you don't mind when they do that. And I'm going to ask you about what your pet peeves are as a mediator, but what are the things that you think divorce lawyers do that are particularly persuasive or effective in mediation from a settlement master perspective or a mediation perspective? What are the things that litigators do or parties do that you find to be effective?
People that come prepared and have analyzed their case and know the strengths and weaknesses of it have a lot better chance of reaching a result in mediation than someone that's just walking in the door with kind of a blank slate, and we're not really sure where we're going, where we're even going to start, how we're going to get there. And so oftentimes in mediation, I will say to one side or the other, sometimes both sides, how can I help you? What would you like me to try to help you do today to try to resolve this case? And so that can sometimes be helpful. But when people come in prepared, and good litigators are always prepared, I believe, or they should be, and they've thought about where they are and where they may have to go, and they prepare their client for that. Look, we may start here, but we're going to probably have to go here to get the case settled. It just makes the process more effective, and you get a lot more cases settled that way than people who either haven't thought through their issues, or they haven't been able to persuade their client, they've not prepared their client for what may happen in mediation. And, you know, I'll go into a room and say, well, look, I've talked to the other side, they analyze it this way, I believe ABC. And sometimes a client will look at me like, what are you talking about?
Because they've never heard that.
Right, never even heard it. And now I know I've got a little bit of a problem that I'm going to have to do some work on. So the more prepared, the better. And the more options people are prepared for, also the better.
You know, I heard a mediator at the CTLA, the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association, the convention, and I can't remember who it was, but it was a mediator. And he said that what he really likes is to have the other party send, you know, a settlement offer and kind of their memo, confidential memo, why that should settle at this particular, and send that to the other side as well as the mediator, but then also to turn around and send him, the mediator, in addition, kind of a supplement, which is essentially like the weaknesses. And you wouldn't identify that to the other party explicitly, but that he, in his mind, it built some credibility because, you know, there's a reason that the case is going to mediation. There are some issues. And when you recognize and appreciate those weaknesses, that it can result in a more effective experience for everyone.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I like to hear what the offers have been because I like to know where I'm starting from. Because sometimes, you know, people will say to me, well, look, what you just told me, I talked with my spouse about a month ago, and I told him I wasn't interested. Well, then I wasted several hours. I mean, if I'd have known that from the beginning, that really wasn't going to go anyplace, then at least I could maybe take a little bit different approach. So I like to know what offers have been made. I certainly like to know confidentially, for sure, where people are in terms of what they may be willing to agree to and just what they can't agree to. And then I can know some of that kind of stuff because I keep my view of effective mediation is we need to share in each room. I keep people separate, except in very rare circumstances. We can talk about that in a minute. But if there's something that a party does not want me to say, then I will keep it to myself. Otherwise, we're all going to hear the same stuff. So I need to know ahead of time what I'm able to talk about and what I'm not able to talk about. For as a simple example is, people will sometimes say, Mike, look, we're probably willing to give on these three issues, but you know, it's only 9:30 in the morning. We've got all day. We really don't want to start there, but we just want you to be aware of that. I'll keep that to myself. But so knowing where people are when they walk in the door is really helpful as opposed to walking into a room and saying, have there been any offers? No. Have you heard anything from the other side about what their position is on settlement? No. Well, where do you think I should start? Well, you go get an offer from them. Well, people are sometimes reluctant to make the first offer in a case, right? So it just works a lot better if there's been some interaction before people get into my realm so that at least I know where they are.
What are the pet peeves? What are the things that you do mind as a mediator?
Well, when parties come into my office completely unprepared for potential results, they're really wasting their time and their money. Few of us, in fact, I can think of maybe only one or two others that are charging the hourly rates that I'm charging. I'm charging $375 an hour to do mediation. You can get it from the court mediation service for $50, $75, $100. So if all you're doing here is checking a box that the courts required you to check, you don't need to spend your client's money on me. You can go somewhere else. So that's my biggest pet peeve, people just not being prepared. The other thing is that I also have a legal practice. So I ask parties if they're going to submit information to me to have it to me a few days before the mediation so that I can take a look at it. Sometimes that happens. Most of the time it doesn't. I'm doing a mediation tomorrow morning where I'm literally getting stuff today. So the rest of my afternoon is going to be occupied trying to get ready for that mediation. And fortunately, I'm not doing anything else today other than this podcast as far as my own practice is concerned. I've got the time.
Well, we do appreciate your time. This episode is brought to you by our law firm, Kalamea Gosha. Amy and I describe our law firm as an innovative and ambitious trial team that pushes the boundaries to discover new frontiers in family law, personal injuries, and criminal defense in Colorado. We currently have offices in Aspen, Glenwood Springs, Edwards, Denver, and Boulder. If you want to find out more, visit our website, kalamea.law. Now, back to the show. And I think back to, you know, a couple of the mediations we've done. And you also, do you offer the phone call or in advance instead of, or do you prefer to have material submitted to you in writing? I know mediators can kind of fall on different sides of that coin.
I think more is accomplished with a joint phone call. And the reason that more is accomplished with it, in my view, one, it's less expensive because a lawyer is not preparing paperwork and then sending it to me. But secondly, I may have some questions that I want to ask while both attorneys are on the phone, things that they haven't told me about that I am interested in as far as trying to help people create a resolution. So for me, setting up a joint phone conference is much more effective than both sides submitting written positions.
Okay, well, and switching gears to arbitration, did you start doing arbitration as an arbiter? Was that just a natural progression with the mediation and Joan McWilliams asking you to, you know, help her out?
Not really. Where the arbitration angle came from was I was part of a group in Arapahoe County that started a special master program to assist the judges in some of their heavy caseloads. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, it just never took off. But that really put me in a position where I was going to be a decision maker, although a decision maker with review by a court. And so that's how that got started. And so once the word got out that we were part of that effort, then people would call and ask me if I'd be willing to arbitrate a particular issue or not. And so I've been doing arbitration work probably the last 15 years.
I mean, arbitration, it's a favored method of dispute resolution by the Colorado courts. I mean, so if the parties agree to arbitration, the courts will generally push them in to that. And we can talk about a case that you were involved where that happened. What are the cases in, or issues rather, in divorces that you think are particularly ripe or ideal for arbitration?
Well, as a general course, when parties reach an agreement in mediation, generally that agreement is not a complete legal document. People will prepare what's called a memorandum of understanding, which is an outline setting forth what their agreement is, because nothing in mediation is binding unless it's in some form of writing and signed. So that memorandum of understanding becomes the writing and it's signed by the parties so that they know they have an agreement. But you have to put that document into a legal form so a court can review it. And there are things that just don't occur in mediation that will need to be put into the final document, like full disclosure of financial affairs, no duress, some of those kinds of things. So I think that So I put in a provision in my mediation agreements with the party's consent that if there's any disagreement about what the parties agreed to or the language of their final separation agreement, that I will arbitrate that issue for the party so that when people walk out the door of my office, they know that they're going to have a final deal done. Because even if there's a dispute between their attorneys about how something should read, or somebody says, gee, that wasn't my understanding of our deal, or I didn't agree to that, that they have a mechanism to create a final resolution. So the issues, so those are general issues. Specific issues, sale of property. People generally do not specify how security documents are going to be drawn. Promissory notes, rates of interest, default interest, some of those kinds of things. So people will say, look, we're going to attempt to agree on the form of these documents, but if we can't, we'll send it to Mike DiManna to arbitrate on what's going to happen. I don't like to arbitrate issues dealing with children. I do not like to do that. I've done it, but it's not one of the things that I prefer. And it's mostly because I am biased in the sense that I think the best decisions for kids are made by their parents, not by some third party, with all due respect to the courts and even to me. So I don't like to do it, but I have done it. And I just don't think that it works as well as how we're going to sell our house or how should the promissory note to provide for the lump sum property division read, some of those kinds of things. That more of the economic issues are ripe for an arbitration.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with you. But I do know Amy, my partner, who she just recently had a case in Douglas County, and the judge essentially gave them 2 hours each. And what I tell clients is, when you've got parenting issues, you can say you're a good parent, but you have to show, not tell. And it's really hard to just roll the dice and say, I'm going to put my kids' livelihood and my family's situation on the line in like a 2 hour kind of hearing. I mean, they might have not, they probably didn't sleep that well that day or that night. And, so if you go that route, then, arbitration, you can kind of show. And it's one of the reasons, for a PRE and CFI, and, that's a whole separate issue. But, the real estate, man, I remember cutting my teeth when the Great Recession hit, and I was just seeing all these slew of separation agreements that just assumed that the property was going to keep on going up, or that they were going to refinance, or that they were going to sell it, but then they didn't put in a provision on like when that would happen. And so that when the issues come up where the market changes, and you can go to someone like you as an arbitrator to make that decision, where the real estate broker might testify, and then the two parties, someone might be dragging their foot or feet because they want to stay in the house. That's something that you can really resolve very quickly, and I think is great for resolving via arbitration.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because as you and I both know, we may have an issue regarding the sale of a house, but to get it in front of a judge, we won't have the issue very long, because the buyer is going to be gone. So whereas an arbiter, you pick up the phone, I can schedule something usually within a couple of days. If it's a critical issue, like whether to accept an offer or reject an offer, or make a counter offer, whatever, I can sometimes set something within a few hours. So we can get right back and have a decision that's made, and the parties know where they're going to go. So that's the benefit of it. For sure.
Just to reiterate what you said, I mean, it doesn't have to be in an agreement that you actually mediate. We'll talk about meet arb next, but I've definitely had agreements with another attorney, and we've agreed to it on our own before mediation or after mediation, whatever the case may be. And we might say on the sale of a house or taxes, for example, that, there's this one issue, and we'll just specifically carve that out for an arbitrator like, you, because we know that, even though we reached this agreement that, and there's not maybe a dispute about the language, but that this is an area that, is really applicable for or relevant for arbitration.
Exactly. That happens all the time.
So meet arb, there's definitely some ethical issues. I'm wondering if you could kind of explain, meet arb from your perspective and some of the issues you have to navigate. You said in your mediation agreement that you've got a provision in there. Can you just walk people through meet arb from your perspective?
Yeah. A meet arb is a short term for a session where parties attempt to mediate their dispute. And if they fail to mediate it, they will give it then to the mediator to act as an arbiter. So we haven't been able to resolve this issue. We've tried to mediate it. We haven't come to a conclusion. Now we want you to act as an arbiter. There are some problems with it. And one of those problems is that in an arbitration, the arbiter is only supposed to make a decision based upon the information presented. So if I've been in a mediation for a half a day or sometimes a full day, and people haven't been able to resolve, and now they want to proceed to arbitration, I will do that, but I will make sure they understand that whatever was told to me in the mediation process will either have to be reiterated again in the arbitration process. And if it's not, I cannot rely on anything that I hear in mediation. Now, the advantage of using the mediator as your arbiter is that I do have a lot of background now in the case. So I know some things about it, where if you're going into a decision-making process, you may want to explain to the decision maker before you get to some of the issues. So from that standpoint, people can feel comfortable with, I have a familiarity with the case. But as far as what they want done, that's going to have to be presented to me anew, because I just simply can't rely upon anything I've heard in the mediation process as an arbiter. Well, the other issue is, of course, that all of the communications in mediation are confidential. So for sure can't be using mediation communications in making my arbitration decision. Arbitrations, at least the arbitrations that I do, are sometimes on the record, not always on the record, but sometimes they are. And again, I tell parties that I'm bound by what I hear in the arbitration process. So if they want me to know something, they need to make sure that they've told me about it, and not say, well, gosh, he knows about that because I told him about that in mediation.
Yeah. And I've always thought about how to reconcile that the information that you learn in mediation, and also just the to reconcile the fact that, as you said, most mediations are taking place in separate rooms, which is ex parte, right? You're not, the various people will make an allegation. The husband will say something against the wife and she's not there to defend herself. It's then up to you in terms of interpreting that. And she might have an opportunity to respond to that in mediation. But in arbitration, you've got this tenet or principle that everyone's going to be in the same room. They're going to be able to hear what the other side says and then respond to that. And so those are obviously in conflict, and there's, you know, different ways to handle that. You can agree. I've seen MediArb agreements where the parties waive confidentiality. That obviously presents some problems because you don't know what the other side was telling the mediator in their kind of caucus or their session. So you could go into arbitration not really even knowing what the issues are as presented by the other side. So I'm just, it's such an interesting concept. I mean, in theory, it makes sense. You're using the same person. And the idea behind that is that there's cost savings, there's some familiarity, but then also you've got this legal construct that you're supposed to forget what you learned during mediation. So how difficult is that, Mike? Like, to be, you know, in full candor, like how, I mean, you're a human being, you have been a divorce lawyer for 50 years, but you are a human being. And, you know, so how is it that easy just to forget what the person said?
No. And that's why I don't like to do it. I really don't. I sometimes think that lawyers believe, and they may be right, that if they're in a mediation session and they haven't been able to settle it, using the same person who is their mediator as their arbiter is preferable because they have some idea, at least if they're using me as a mediator, they have some idea about where I'm coming from. Because I've said, look, I just don't think this is a very strong position. I don't think you're going to succeed with that in court. So if they've set their client up that we're going to use Mike DiManna to mediate this, but we can't settle it, we want to use him as the arbiter, the client's going to fairly know in advance where this is going to go. And sometimes as a party in mediation, it's helpful because I can say, look, we've been doing this all day. You've heard the mediator's position on our position. It can be a helpful solution, but it also can be a problem because you've kind of telegraphed where you are already on the issue. So that's why I don't prefer it. I don't have any problem with arbitrating what the parties agreed to, terms of their agreement, those kinds of things, because that's pretty simple and it's a lot, process is streamlined. But when I'm actually, an issue is being brought to me for a decision that I have not mediated previously, then it's like an actual court trial where we have a binding decision maker. So there are some differences.
Yeah. And I know that there's different variations or solutions to this. I mean, because one thing about MediArb is that it's kind of the Wild West. There's no real protocols or universally accepted standards so that you've got these kind of not renegade, but you've got these different protocols. So there's the overlapping or split neutrals where, you know, you've got one party or one person like you doing mediation and then somebody else doing the arbitration. And it kind of reduces the concern about, you know, that the communication issues and the information sharing. Then you've got the plenary where it's like everyone is in the same room. So they do mediation and then, you know, but they are, it's they, when the husband says something, the wife can dispute it. But then obviously you've got costs or, you know, not necessarily expense, but that, you know, people aren't going to be as candid in that circumstance. And then it can also devolve into just kind of finger pointing. So, I mean, those are the solutions. But for you in the traditional mediation, you know, practice, it's, they're not acceptable solutions, or at least they have some pretty significant costs, don't they?
They do. And I guess I would say there are solutions, but they're not preferred. So we try to get things done in mediation if we can, but certainly if not, and people want a quick resolution, then we can proceed to arbitration.
Now, I'm going to ask you, and we can cut this, of course, Al, if you don't feel comfortable, but you were involved in the intermarriage of Dorsey. It's a published case where MediArb was at issue. Can you tell us a little bit, you know, about that case?
Yes. The Dorseys were parties who had a fairly significant estate. They had a difficult time agreeing to virtually anything. The case ultimately, though, did get settled. And the issue that arose was with what we call the boilerplate parts of the agreement. There were two provisions in the standard provisions that we put in these separation agreements, one dealing with the jurisdictional aspects of where disputes would be resolved. And that said in the courts of the state of Colorado under Colorado law. And then there was a separate provision which said that if there was a dispute, the parties would proceed to mediate it. And if unresolved in mediation, would then proceed to arbitrate it. So when there was a dispute and we could not get an agreement on it, Mrs. Dorsey filed a motion with the court to have the court resolve that dispute under Colorado law. We, of course, objected and said there's an arbitration clause in this agreement and therefore the case needs to be arbitrated. That's what then we won at the trial court level. That's what then went up to the Court of Appeals. And there's a footnote in that case where the Court of Appeals says, had the parties been more careful with their drafting, this issue may not have reached us. It wouldn't have changed our result. But you need to look at, in essence, you need to look at your boilerplate more carefully. So from that point forward, I have looked at my boilerplate more carefully.
Indeed. I mean, I think, well, it was like a $4 million payment, according to the opinion. So there was some, you know, significant funds at stake. And if I remember correctly from the opinion, I mean, basically the provision, the Meade-Arb provision said that it would Meade-Arb or arbitration was going to be for any dispute. But if it had said that specific disputes or, like, for example, real estate, then you're excluding everything else. So you're saying we'll do Meade-Arb on the real estate and on the payment of the $4 million. So that could have fallen out, but it was such a broad brush that you guys, you know, that was contained in the boilerplate that resulted in the arbitration process.
Correct. And interestingly enough, that agreement was drawn by Mrs. Dorsey's attorney. So it wasn't my language, but as I said, I've learned from that case. And if I want to limit what's going to be mediated and arbitrated, I need to say it. Otherwise, anything that arises is going to go to that alternative dispute resolution process.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about appeal and review, but you know, you just kind of said something that resonated to me. And I think a lot of parties going through divorce, we will, you know, oftentimes divorce lawyers will tell these kind of war stories and kind of horror stories when you have this inadvertent kind of mistake or oversight, some bad things can happen. And we've seen it where an unintended consequence can result in an appeal, a trial. And so that's why I think, you know, a lot of parties, they're just like, why are you so concerned about this? Or why this is not an issue? Like we've got figured everything out on a parenting plan, like, or a parenting schedule. Why do we even need a parenting plan? You know, just as kind of an example, but it's those circumstances when you see really things go wrong that can guide the agreements and in particular on the boilerplate.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, Mrs. Dorsey had some creative lawyers that wanted to get her out of an unpopular decision that was made by the arbitrator. But clearly, Colorado courts prefer alternative dispute resolution processes. So even though we could have done a better job with the drafting, the result that came out the way it should have.
So to, you know, kind of put a close on things. So instead of having creative lawyers, which is always good, what happens when someone is unhappy with an arbitration? What are their options other than kind of creative solutions? What's the kind of standard solution?
Well, that's why courts prefer arbitration, because it is final. The Colorado Arbitration Act has very few grounds that can create a reversal of an arbitration award. They're very specifically set out in the statute. They deal with things like, the arbiter had an interest in the case, stuff like that. And so when you walk out of an arbitration with an arbitration decision, that's going to virtually be the end of it. There will be very little that can be done about it. And so people should be careful about what they choose to arbitrate. They should be careful about who they choose as their arbiter. They should understand, as in my arbitrations, I lay out the process that's going to be followed, the rules of evidence that will be applied, some of those kinds of things, so that everybody knows up front what's going to happen. Because once I put my signature on that award, the likelihood that a court's going to be able to do anything about it is not very great.
And I think a lot of lawyers and parties may overlook that because they, in their mind, like a PCDM, for example, a parenting coordinator decision maker, there's this procedure to appeal or go to the district court and have a review. I mean, under 14.10.128.5, there's a provision about a de novo hearing on an arbitration for parenting. But I think a lot of lawyers just go into it just thinking, oh, I can just appeal this. It will be just really easy with an arbitration. You know, there's also, as I'm sure you're aware, that, you know, some interesting case law about whether or not you can hold someone in contempt in connection with an arbitration award when that arbitration award hasn't been, you know, approved or entered in as judgment by the district court. So, I mean, there's so many interesting things. You know, Mike, I really appreciate, and I know our listeners really appreciate you joining us and sharing your 50 years of wisdom, and, you know, look forward to seeing you in mediation sometime in future. But thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome, Ryan. Tell Amy I said hello.
Will do. Thanks again.
Hey everyone, this is Ryan again. Thank you for joining us on Divorce at Altitude. If you found our tips, insight, or discussion helpful, please tell a friend about this podcast. For show notes, additional resources, or links mentioned on today's episode, visit divorceataltitude.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen in. Many of our episodes are also posted on YouTube. You can also find Amy and me at kalamea.law or 970-315-2365. That's kalamaya.law.